and welcome back to the Earthon Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters, with your questers Josh and Dan. I am Dan.
I am Josh.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing more things trollical, and we've actually got one quizzical thing to get to. We have one email from one listener who just found us for the first time. Welcome, Chris, and I'm going to read his email title, There's an Earthon Podcast? Holy shit! I just discovered your podcast, and I've been playing and running Earthon since 1994. I even helped Living Room Games playtest 2nd edition. My name should still be in the playtest credits, Chris. I wasn't a huge fan of 2nd, but found Red Brick by digging through the internet trenches and was in communication with those folks during the production of Classic edition. I went by the online handle Shady Dragon, if I recall correctly. I've been running a hybrid version of Classic and 4th edition campaign for almost 6 straight years now, and I've even created automated Google character sheets. Good on you, Chris. Love you guys for doing this, and if you ever want a guest who considers himself a master in all Earthon lore, I'm just an email away. Chris.
Well, Chris,
says the master of Earthon lore. I'm calling you a master of Earthon lore.
I mean, look, there's me, there's the Council of Joles.
Lou.
There are a few of us out there. Admittedly, Lou may have forgotten more things about the lore than I ever sort of knew in the first place. It's actually been kind of amusing reading his reactions to the episodes that we've been doing lately on the horrors, because he's like, oh yeah, I forgot about these guys. Because there are several of the horrors in there that really don't have any reference or appearance anywhere else.
Yes.
And never really factored into the broader setting development. He mentioned actually in his response to the episode that dropped today about Ozvat and the Tempter, about an adventure idea framework or something like that, that he had about, or that was in development, that was like floating around about Ozvat and how one of its cursed items might show up in Europa and cause problems there, kind of thing. It's really cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, it has been many, many years, but I think I kind of remember Chris from the
chat rooms and
the early Red Brick. Well, the early Red Brick days and whatnot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, cool. Welcome. You have lots of content to get through.
170 some odd.
171 episodes as we are recording right now.
Yes.
Not to additionally count bonus content and various other things that are in there.
Absolutely.
But yeah, cool. Great. The show's out there and it's continuing to go
pretty well. Yeah. And we'll take all the new listeners we possibly can. So since you just found us, spread the word. And if you are listening and getting people into Earthon, spread the word.
Yeah.
About the game and the podcast. Game first, podcast second. We know it's important. We do.
Speaking of that, slight side tangent here.
Do it.
This past weekend, I ran Earthdawn for the first time in a non-convention setting. I actually did. I think I had mentioned I was running a game for folks that was like running for about a year.
Oh, yeah.
Or so. But this was not online. This was actually in person with my current girlfriend and her family and my youngest. Got together and made characters. And man, I am out of practice helping people make characters.
Fair.
And then we played for a little bit and everybody had a good time and talking about getting together to do it again. So whether this ends up into a longer term sort of thing, it was cool. I had a good time doing it and introducing new folks to the game.
Absolutely. Love how that all worked out. So if you have any questions for us, because Chris did, actually, he didn't really have a question. He just had a statement. Anyway, if you have
I think his question was, how had I not heard about this sooner?
Actually, the question was, is there an Earthon podcast? Yes, there is.
Yes,
so
there is.
So if you have your own question along the same lines, please feel free to drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you, and we will, of course, read your email on the podcast. I can't call it the air because it's not live. So there's that. Anyway, we have another installment of our Life Among the Crystal Raiders tonight.
And this probably is the last one.
We hope the
maybe
last
the last one.
Maybe. Maybe second sure. last. We'll figure it out. There might be more. We'll dig around and mine and cobble together. All that fun stuff. So this is pretty much about the social aspects of Crystal Raider culture and their importance on everything else that they actually do. So trolls traditionally create items that are both useful and beautiful. They go for use first. So when they create their bowling ball, they don't put lace on it until after it's created. I'm kidding. But crystal raiders are best known for their crystal armor and their crystal weapons. And all of this, of course, has some very intricate detail. It's all very pretty because that's what they like to do. But they make it for use first and then beauty and aesthetics second. The crystal raiders view stone as their most important building material because it is hard, it is strong, it is unyielding, it is sharp-edged, exactly like the crystal raiders themselves.
And there is a lot of it in the mountains.
Yes. So it's bountiful, plentiful, found everywhere. And since wood is rare, they really don't want to use a whole lot of wood for their armor, or they really reserve wood for shipbuilding.
Which we will be getting to. And to be perfectly honest, wood is okay.
Yeah.
As armor or weapon material if you don't have something else.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you have stone, and especially when you have living crystal, wood is a lesser substitute for those things.
Yes.
And then, of course, you've got the hides and leather that you can make from the skins of animals that you either raise, like their goats and whatnot, or mm-hmm. that you slay among the mountain passes. Some of the more dangerous creatures would also be used to make armor and stuff like that.
Absolutely. And they would use every part of that animal that they possibly could, because resources up there are scarce.
As we have discussed.
Exactly. So the weaponsmiths among the crystal raiders rarely ever work in metal. They use gold, silver, and copper for ornamentation because the resources to mine those and refine those are a little bit lesser than turning, you know, blanket ore into steel. Because gold, silver, and copper kind of show up as they are, really, in the mountains. So those are easier to use and easier to incorporate, but they really don't use a whole lot of steel because that takes iron ore and refining it and heating it, and that's resource heavy with all of the wood you can't burn to make a fire. So
yeah. And in addition to that, there's the general thing that we've been talking about with Crystal Raider culture, that agriculture and farming and those sorts of tasks are considered more lowland and not as honorable or as true to the way that trolls should live. I mean, you have some exceptions to that with the Ironmongers and, to a lesser extent, the Blackfangs, both of which do take part in some degree of mining.
Yeah.
But there is not as much of it. It is not as prominent a situation. And in the Ironmonger's case, they've got the dwarves among them. Is that the one? I'm not remembering now, and I don't have my notes handy.
No, Stoneclaws.
Stoneclaws? Okay. But anyway, that is another aspect. Not only is it resource intensive, but it is something that is not viewed quite as honorably as being a raider and living the epitome of crystal raider life.
I was right. It was the stone claws. Yay. Yay me.
Once you said it, I knew you were right. I just couldn't remember off the top of my head.
I'm not usually right though. So that's the thing.
That's not true.
I'm Stop not often it. Right. How's that? I'll just delete all this. Anyway,
look, there's nothing wrong with looking things up in order to be sure you're right, as opposed to spouting some nonsense off the top of your head like I sometimes do.
Yeah, but even when you do it, you're more right than I am.
This is the kind of discussion that people come to us for.
I don't know why.
We're both a little punchy tonight, as you can probably tell.
So there's a lovely troll word for a stonesmith, which is basically somebody who works as a stone worker, and it's ago atal. And so that is the stonesmith. There's also a special word for a crystal smith, which is the care ago atal. And it basically translates into bright stone worker, because they view living crystal as bright stones, because they're basically transparent stones or sometimes semi-opaque stones, but they are still stone, and they cherish living crystal more so than just about any other material out there. Except for one, and we will get to that.
Yes, for reasons that we discussed earlier with regards to the living crystal being the tears of the mother or something along those lines. Wasn't that a legend that we talked about?
Oh, I loved that legend. I just need to find it again.
We talked about it like 2 weeks ago.
Yes. The spirit of all things.
The spirit of all things. Yeah.
Yes. Because her true children, her tears fell to earth and seeped into the stone of the mountains, becoming as hard as stone themselves. That is the living crystal. So, and her true children are, of course, the trolls and the obsidian. Anyway, when the stonesmiths and the crystal smiths are making their body armor and their shields and their weapons and things like that, they usually only reserve the living crystal for the most respected fighters and those that are worthy of the crystal armor and those weapons. And so it's kind of not exactly a merit system, meritocracy for that, but it's the most honorable, the most fierce, the best fighters get the best stuff. And the artists among the clans frequently emblazon elaborate symbolic clan markings on shields and body paintings, even on the ships themselves. And all these artists also, by the way, kind of revere tattooing as a absolute artisan skill, because that was also developed during the Scourge. Artisan skills were really hammered home during the Scourge in the Crystal Raider clans. But when they do the tattooing, the clan symbols sometimes are enchanted with blood magic and whatnot and crystal magic for strength or endurance for those fighters.
Yeah, the other aspect of the arts and crafts is that much like more isolated societies in other parts of Barsave, isolated communities and folks in the hinterlands and whatnot, view the practice of craftsmanship as a way of demonstrating one's freedom from the touch of the horrors. But there is also a spiritual aspect that goes along with that with the trolls.
Yes.
It is a spirituality. The troll term for it is Jar Arak. That it is as complex and perhaps even more mysterious than honor among the trolls.
Yeah.
Once they are explained, the concepts of personal clan and troll racial honor, they might seem strange, but they do have their own kind of internal logic about them.
Yeah.
But Jar Arak is much more philosophical and spiritual and internal and personal to a degree. And so it is that dichotomy that I think we had talked about with the trolls quite a ways back, where you've got this like fierce, aggressive, talking about the Highland trolls primarily, but this fierce, aggressive, scream your name to the world to make sure it knows you're there kind of thing.
Yes.
In contrast to the quiet, contemplative, internal, reflective nature of working on an item, whether that's crafting a weapon or a shield or clothing or household items.
Mm-hmm.
That practice is the quiet, the counterpoint to that aggression. And so it is a very personal thing and not discussed or debated to the extent that honor is. In fact, sort of questioning a troll's connection to that idea can be taken as an insult to personal honor.
Yes. Yeah, because Jar Arak is kind of like a Venn diagram of your religion, your philosophy, your artistic nature, your contemplative side. And so to your point,
your personal connection with the universe itself.
Yes. And your place in it. And that's the internal dialogue or the internal monologue, internal monologue you have with yourself about your actions and your relationship to the world, the mountaintop, you know, your family, so forth and so on, before you ever get to the honor, personal clan and race. So it's just as important a concept as the honor. And so to Josh's point, it's the balancing act on the teeter-totter there of your spirituality, Jar Arak, or your honor, and all three phases of that honor.
Yeah, and I think the two are very strongly intertwined.
Yes.
But it is a much more personal practice, a much more individual practice within the greater framework of the cultural Crystal Raider Highland Troll milieu that is defined by honor, which is the broader cultural framework in which this all exists. There's the idea that, again, when we first talked about trolls like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, however long it was at this point.
100 episodes.
The idea that they are the dual people.
Yes.
The literal translation into Throlic of their word for themselves is the dual people.
Yeah.
There is this dichotomy, this balance that exists in them that is kind of key to the Highland culture, is all kind of wrapped up in this idea.
Yeah.
And there is a almost stark beauty to the functionality of troll goods, that while they do decorate them with clan insignias or something that might commemorate an important event that this axe was used in, that they'll mark the handle or inscribe it in some way to do that, the goods that they make are to serve a purpose. And the fact that it is fulfilling its purpose in its own way is beautiful. What makes it beautiful.
Yeah.
You're not looking at the elaborate, complex aesthetics that you might see from, say, elven court art, which has a very different cultural framework that is built around it because of the idea among the elves that taking the time to make an item beautiful above and beyond its function is how you demonstrate your care and dedication to your craft.
Yeah.
That you have developed your skills to the point where it is almost the beauty itself that is the thing, as opposed to the trolls. And that can be an interesting cultural conflict or contrast that you could use, whether you're playing a troll that is like a Highland troll especially, but a troll that is encountering different cultural frameworks and how they might react to that, or vice versa.
Yeah.
If you're a GM and how you might present those kind of contrasting things, a troll might view a beautiful, elaborate set of, but talking about how they would view a beautiful high court elven fashion.
Yes. Sorry.
Or the kind of stuff that would be crafted or that would be at the table of a noble or wealthy merchant or something like that, where you have these really delicate and elaborate stuff that, to be honest, for a troll would be difficult because of their size and how often the world is not built for them.
Yeah.
And so something that is like an incredibly delicate champagne flute, a troll would find clumsy and not functional because they wouldn't be able to use it.
It's so brittle in their hands.
Yeah.
It's pretty, but not functional. And trolls are all about function first and pretty second.
The fact that there is that so much of what one finds beautiful or aesthetic or attractive is wrapped up in one's cultural trappings, in one's cultural upbringing, that kind of idea.
Yeah.
And again, adding a layer of verisimilitude of reality and complexity to a people that early on in the game line are presented in a very simplistic, straightforward fashion.
Yeah.
Again, really, like we've talked about, I've mentioned this a lot, the depth of setting development and the complexity and variety that we encounter, even when looking at what would seemingly be a monolithic group.
Yeah.
The variety among the troll moots.
Totally.
The variety among the different Tuskrang houses.
Yes.
You know, the issues that you have with the Orcish diaspora and Carafad and the different tribes that come together in addition to the quote-unquote city orcs.
Yeah.
How they are in the process of figuring out what their cultural identity is, both by exploring the past, having the opportunity to be back in their homeland and to be able to explore that history and discover it and figure out how that defines them and what that means for them, and how a lot of the conflicts in Carafad internally are all about the different groups who all have their own ideas about what it means to be an orc, to be a Carad.
Yeah.
And how that is something that Krathus Gron is having to navigate and juggle as the leader of this very young nation that is finding itself.
Exactly.
It's all really, really cool. But back to trolls. That was a wonderful little
sidebar.
Sidebar, but I think very important and something to keep in mind when you are developing stuff for your own game and how that sort of thing can drive story and interactions and conflicts and whatnot. And it's something that I try and keep in mind when I'm working on stuff, you know, to talk specifically or not specifically about it, but to like wave in the direction of the Europa book.
Yes.
How that is a city that is developed on the foundations of multiple cultural backgrounds that have all come together in one place, and how that over the course of a generation or two has shaped what the city has developed into and what it might develop into in the future.
Yeah.
And what you can do with that.
Well, if you didn't have that sidebar, I was going to say something to spur you on to have that sidebar, which is, I agree that not only in this book, the Crystal Raiders book, but in the Serpent River book and in the Thrall Kingdom book, that time was taken, effort was taken to expand upon all of these cultures and put as many facets, usable facets into them as possible, so that the Crystal Raiders just didn't come off like some big dumb brutes that all they do is conquer and thieve. That takes up a paragraph. This right. is 100 plus pages in this book that really fleshes out a culture, a race, a society, and a way of life, and does it with different aspects. And so I like that throughout all of Earth Dawn, which is why it's my favorite game, time was taken to do that in spades across all these races, across all these cultures, so that the player would have a way in to say, this, my character agrees with this. My character, I want to play this aspect of it. And then if you're the game master, you can just bring in the culture as a sidebar to this attitude the NPCs are going to have when talking to the characters. And so you have all this dynamic drama going on that just enhances and enriches the game.
Yeah. This just occurred to me, but I think that may be one of the reasons why the Theron Empire book was not quite as well received.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that book, you've got the island of Great Thera.
Yeah.
And then you've got five other entire regions that are the size of Barsave.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, that only get a 20 pages a piece to them.
Yeah.
And so you don't get the depth of cultural exploration and mm-hmm. the variety and the nuance that people had come to expect from books like Serpent River, like Crystal Raiders, like Thrall, where you have these rich, complex, interesting cultures, and instead they come across as pastiche.
Yeah.
When you go back as far as the Vivain source book or mm-hmm. the Vivain box set,
yeah,
these areas are sort of initially described in their one or two paragraph summaries. The seeds of what is there in the Theron Empire book was already there then. And I think it's just the fact that that much farther into the development of the line, with the richness and the variety and the nuance that had gone to develop Barsave up to that mm-hmm. point,
yeah,
was not present in the Theron Empire book simply because of the nature of what that book had to cover and how much space it had to cover and what little space it had to explore each of those. And that's why I've always felt that while the Theron Empire book does have its issues, there is plenty of room within that to explore deeper and to find the variety and to find the twists, like has been done to an extent with the Vasgothia book, which is a much more expansive and in-depth exploration that starts from where the initial idea was, and then from Robin Law's chapter on it in the Theron Empire book, and kind of expanding from there, and that you could probably do something very similar with the other provinces in there with greater or lesser ease, depending on what you're trying to find in it.
Yeah. I was going to say, we've got Vasgothia. We just need the other four.
Yeah. Well,
books.
There is nothing on the table right now for anything that is in serious development for any of those.
No, just saying. Eventually, it's a wish list.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that hopefully people will feel that about the Arancia project when yes. that finally gets released. Because that's an area that has had very little development about it. And mm-hmm. the hope that is a book devoted to this will have the variety and nuance and so forth to not come across as either a warmed over mm-hmm. bar save analog just in another part of the world
yep.
or too much of a
carbon copy of something else.
Carbon copy, Forgotten Realms ish, Mystara ish.
Yeah.
This is the nation that is modeled after Vikings. This is the nation that is modeled after the Arabian Nights.
Mm hmm.
That is an impression that you certainly can, I think, validly take away
yeah.
from certain readings of the Theron Empire book. Anyway.
No, it's fun. I'm enjoying the Crystal Raiders book in its entirety, rediscovering it again for the first time in 20-odd years. So that explains the smithing, the crystal smithing, their artistry. So the materials that they get to use, however, is where the mining comes in for the Crystal Raiders, because, of course, they live among the mountains. They have to mine true air from the high winds above the mountains. They have to mine true fire, which flows in Death Sea. They have to mine true earth, which is buried, of course, in the mountains themselves. They have to mine true wood, which, again, is rare, and they guard it zealously because it is so rare up in the above the tree line, essentially. And they have to mine true water, which is also rare, but can be found in small amounts in mountain streams. And so there's this resource requirement that the Crystal Raiders have. And so they have to balance all those out.
Yeah. And then coupled with that, leaning back a little bit into the importance and significance of crystal weapons and crystal armor, because they are reserved for the higher status, the more accomplished, the more powerful, the more successful
yeah.
warriors and sky raiders and members of the raiding parties, those items tend to be in close proximity to more significant uses of magic.
Yep.
If you've got this crystal axe that was created generations ago mm-hmm. and is used and passed down, not even necessarily like from parent to child.
No, yeah.
But just in general, like passed from
successful warrior to the next
one successful warrior to another. Yeah. And that those will often become enchanted if they weren't already.
Yeah.
Spontaneously enchanted on their own, or to become pattern items mm-hmm. of the tribe or moot or clan that they are a part of as a part of the history. And yeah. would then offer their own kind of power to the chief or war leader or whatever that is able to wield them.
Yeah. And throughout all of this mining, of course, they have to have, orichalcum nets to do all the mining with, and orichalcum pots to keep all the true elements in. The raiders themselves protect their airspace and their resources, since there are so few of them that it is not quite like an episode of Hoarders, because that's the wrong way to use it. It's more like the episode of, I only have two of these things, and I will die on this hill to protect them, because I only have two, and they have to last forever. So we went through all the true elements that they can get a hold of, but the orichalcum in the mountains themselves has some... you can go through the mountains and find some productive veins that maybe have been undiscovered or untapped so far. But the way the Crystal Raiders use orichalcum is to mend tools, maybe to mine other more useful elements like the true air, the true fire, and so forth and so on. They occasionally use orichalcum for enchantments and artwork, but they view orichalcum as a broad culture. All of the Crystal Raider moots view orichalcum that... any orichalcum in the mountains has been paid for in Crystal Raider blood and is therefore owned by all the clans. So
yeah,
Mining or a calcum requires lots of ceremony, lots of ritual to honor any of the people who've passed on defending it through the Orichalcum Wars, and they will defend stores of Orichalcum, and the raiders will show you no mercy regarding that.
And access to and gaining those resources can often be a high price and a primary target for raids.
Yeah.
Because of the dangers involved with mining True Fire, especially. The Crystal Raiders really like striking against fire mining operations and airships because they will have the True Fire the trolls then claim for themselves. Actually, just occurred to me that it would, you mentioned Orichalcum being used for repair.
Yeah.
There's the, I think it's Japanese, art of repairing objects with gold.
Yes.
I forget what the term for it is.
Give me a second. I'll look it up because I
you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I know it.
And I just like suddenly had this image of the functionality of troll artisans crafts.
Kintsugi.
Okay. Yes. That I knew it was something like that.
Kintsugi. Kintsugi.
That the functional beauty, the stark simplicity in a way of the aesthetics of troll crafts and troll goods. Yes. Highland. Again, when I say troll here, I'm generally meaning
we're talking
Highland
Crystal
troll.
Raiders, yes.
We're talking the Crystal Raiders. We're talking Highland troll culture, but having that combined with that kind of idea where you repair a good with something to highlight the use that it has seen. The fact that function is an aesthetic all its own.
Yes.
An item who has been, that has been used to the point where it needs to be repaired is one that has been serving its purpose.
Yes.
And to repair it in a way that honors that use, like, is something that that's an interesting potential aesthetic that you could bring into some of the designs, especially for more notable items that you might craft, whether it's something that the troll chieftain has as one of their items, or if it's a thread item that you come up with in your game as one of the backstory aspects or one of related to one of the key knowledges or how the item looks in the first place, of having that kind of aspect to it, that the shield of the chief of this clan is a crystal buckler, for example, that at some point in its history, it was shattered when the chief was defending his clan against an assault on their home by a horror or something, and the horror shattered the shield, and they took the broken fragments and put them back together with Orichalcum.
Yeah.
It's just a really cool, like, image and story and everything that kind of goes along with that.
There is no better encapsulation of Jar-Arak than the Kintsugi using Orichalcum to repair the function.
And again, it's certainly not in any kind of attempt to appropriate that, but it's like looking at it as and recognizing sort of the cultural significance that that sort of has, and maybe taking that as, I mean, we're all stewing in the juices of our world, of our culture and what we're exposed to. And it's not cosplaying it. It's like treating it with the respect and reverence and honor
admiration
that it deserves, and admiration that it deserves, and seeing how that is important culturally, that it's not just a superficial thing, that the reason that this is important is because of all of these cultural ideas and morals and aesthetics that all underlie it.
Yeah.
An item that is serving its purpose is beautiful because that's what it is intended to do. To repair it so it can continue to serve that purpose in a way that honors the use that it has seen, that's very recognizable as a kind of spiritual, philosophical aspect.
Yeah.
Especially in contrast to our Western
disposable culture.
Disposable culture where, rather than things being fixed or mended, you just chuck it out and go get a new one.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got a people and a culture that is so steeped in an environment that is low on resources, everything becomes important, and making things last as long as you can.
And everything has to work
yeah, is a moral value of its own.
Yeah.
That in some respects might be a little bit alien or foreign to us mm-hmm. in the present day. And again, this is where you start getting into the ideas of the game and its setting being a reflection of ourselves, of our own present day, and how we often, when we're dealing with historical cultures, like the past is a different country. The yeah. things that were important and the things that were hot button topics and the things that were big deals or that are big deals today
mm-hmm.
did not have the same context or meaning or significance even to people in the same geographical area centuries ago.
Yes.
Because of, you know, the development of things over time. It's all just fascinating. I, armchair anthropologist.
Sociologist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The idea of peoples and cultures and how their environment shapes them and how they shape their environment and what they find important and what mm-hmm. is significant and holy, for lack of a better term, and moral. Yeah. It's all just fascinating and wonderful and highlights the diversity of the world and humanity that we often don't get in our
entertainment.
In our entertainment, in our, like, yeah, pop culture dominance that mm-hmm. the US and whatnot has in the rest of the world as our sort yeah. of export of culture, of yeah. our sort of dominance of the world in that respect, not just in the others.
Mm-hmm. No.
I'm like, wow, I am up on my soapbox tonight, am I?
We could almost just cut this in half and do the other half of the episode, just release this as a two-parter.
No, no, because this all is within the context of
yeah.
troll culture. Like, this is all being inspired by troll culture
oh,
as
yeah.
the jumping off point for all of this. And some listeners may find this absolutely dull and wondering why I'm going off on this.
No, this is what
this makes is Earth part
Dawn,
of why
this is what makes Earth on Earth Dawn.
Exactly.
I haven't come across another role-playing game that goes this in depth.
There are others.
I know. I'm just saying I haven't come across one. But to go
Glorantha,
with this in depth on,
for example,
on the Gistrang, on Crystal Raiders, on the elves, on the orcs. Come on.
Yeah, Glorantha is one example that comes to mind. That's the setting for the RuneQuest games and the various iterations thereof.
Fair.
Glorantha is a setting that has actually, God, if I remember correctly, first showed up in a board game released by the settings creator back around the time that D&D was first coming out, like back in the mid-70s, early wow. 70s. That's how long that setting has been around. And of course, developed by dozens of people over the years mm-hmm. and just expanded.
Added on to.
So like that's another setting that if you want to get lost in the weeds in terms of yeah. depth and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, there are others out there. They just, like Earthdawn, mm-hmm. don't tend to be big name
yeah.
ones that necessarily pop right into the mind of people who are not as steeped in gaming industry, game yeah. history and whatnot
yeah.
that I am.
Well,
or that other people are.
And not everybody can know every game. However.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah. There's way too much. Way, way too much published material to know them all.
Again, Designers and Dragons, 4 volumes, while it is focused mainly on the companies, that is a series of books that will give you a really good overview of the companies that have shaped the industry, both from its earliest days up to yeah. Now at this point, 10 years ago.
I did pick up 3 of those volumes, volumes 2, 3, and 4.
But yeah, really, really good and a good way to get an overview because it also talks about the settings mm-hmm. and the influences and the cross-pollinations and
totally.
All of that stuff.
Yeah.
Wonderful work. And I can't wait till he's finished his work on the next volume because I think he is working on it.
Cool. Well, yeah, you should because if they're all done by a decade, then the last one just ended. So a couple years ago. Absolutely. Back to the trolls.
Back to the trolls. I didn't think we were going to get an hour out of this episode.
We're going to get an hour and a half out of this episode and cut it in half. So we talked about all of their mining, their smithing, their creation of things. So what's one of the most important things that they actually create in their troll moots? Their airships.
Exactly.
This is their lifeblood of the Crystal Raider moots. All of the Crystal Raider moots. Raiders typically only build, and I'm going to use that word there importantly, build Drakkars. As we said, the Black Fangs have a stone airship, but they didn't build
They have three stone
it.
Airships.
Yeah, they didn't build those. They absconded with those. They took those over. Didn't they?
I thought that they had built them back in the earliest, in the early days, but
right.
they had lost the knowledge to make them.
Build a new one. Yeah.
To build
new ones.
They can
barely keep them in repair. They don't know how to create a new one. Right. So, typically speaking, nowadays, any of the Crystal Raider moots only build Drakkars because they are sleek. They are sturdy because they are built for speed and power. So, the stone airships are a different beast to wrangle as far as that's concerned. They're not as sleek. They are a whole lot more sturdy, but it's like driving a tank versus driving, I don't know, a court or a sports car.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of like the difference between a World War II era Sherman tank versus like
modern tank.
Not a tank, but more like one of those armored like assault personnel Humvees. Carrier kind of thing, like a Humvee, like the military Humvees or that sort of thing,
fair.
Where it's built not quite as much for durability, although they are, but but for speed and maneuverability and the needs of the missions that it is going on.
Totally, because when they build Drakkars, they build them in whatever size they need, but they typically kind of maintain their fleet. They don't really want to expand it a whole lot because that takes more resources than they actually have. So when they build a large Drakkar, or use a large Drakkar, that is for a long-range raid. A lot of people, a lot of resources, long trip. Small Drakkars are quick, short-range, like fighters, and for short-range raids. Other moots, down the hill, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and the Drakkars, although while in the art there is an incredible variety in how they are portrayed.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, airships in general. The art across the editions have shown quite a number of different ways that these ships could look. Broadly speaking, the Drakkars are kind of inspired by / modeled after the Viking longships.
Totally.
Because, of course, the Crystal Raider culture is inspired in large part by the classical idea of the Vikings.
Yes.
And the Norse cultural milieu that kind of goes along with them.
Yeah, it's kind of inescapable. The parallel can be drawn rather easily.
Look, the original like promo flyers didn't call them Sky Raiders. I think they just called them Sky Vikings.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I've got, I actually just picked up that promo flyer off of eBay.
The inspiration is not really shrouded at all.
No, it's pretty clear cut. So me being living in a landlocked state, I don't usually go on boats a whole lot. Seafaring or otherwise, and I know I'm talking otherwise as in airships, and no one's been on an airship. So there are a few different positions on the airship.
Not a Barsavian-style airship. I mean, they're
exactly.
Zeppelins and blimps and airplanes and stuff like that.
Totally.
But nobody has been in an actual, like, flying boat.
No. Big difference. I love the fact that the Crystal Raiders book has expanded upon exactly how these boats work, because I'm a details GM, and my players have made me a detail GM. They want to know how stuff works and can break and so forth and so on. So the helm directs the course of most of the Drakkars by a steering contraption, steering wheel, and it pilots rudders in the back of the ship, which, of course, are like aerofoils, and they work like airplane wings and direct air currents to make you go up and down. Captain's wheel basically is for side to side. There's a lever for ascent and descent in the airships. So that is your three-dimensional piloting. And speaking of artwork, the prow of of all the Drakkars is the leading edge, of course. And all Crystal Raider Drakkars have a carved figurehead on them. These are usually some kind of a fierce beast, not like a sexy maidenhead woman usually on English pirate ships. These are all contain magic. The carvings do, the figureheads do, to enhance the performance of the ship, either for endurance or for speed or for armor, whatever the case may be. So the function of the figurehead, the carved beast figurehead, is to A, partially aesthetics, but B, it's enchanted. So therefore, it enhances the ship. So it's that whole...
It is an integral part of the enchantment and function of the airship itself. Because of the rituals and ceremonies and enchantment design that the Crystal Raiders have developed over the centuries that they have been using and constructing airships, the prow, the figurehead, is an integral part of that construction.
Yeah.
And to not have that is in a way to alter the pattern of an airship itself, or what an airship is supposed to be, to, in a sense, kind of render it non-functional.
Yeah.
It is not something that is added on as an additional enchantment. It is part of the entire enchantment process that is what makes an airship an airship.
Yeah.
We're going to try not to get too much in the weeds on these, because we did an entire episode a while back.
Yes.
Dedicated to airships and riverboats.
Totally.
But there's just the general premise that the primary premise, the fundamental law, in a sense, that allows airships to work the way that they do is the law of similarity, where it is constructed to resemble a boat and enchanted to operate in the air in the same way that a regular boat operates in the water.
Totally.
You just need to have some extra stuff in there to allow for the three-dimensional ascent, descent. The rudders, the airfoils move the air currents the same way that the rudder on a boat manipulates the currents of the water and deals with the fluid there to steer it around.
Totally. Yeah, the entire structure of the Jakar, when they create this, is woven with true air, including the sails, to get the thing buoyant in the air, of course, to decrease its weight in, so that it can be more aerodynamic and lighter through the air. The keel and the mast are woven with true wood for strength and flexibility.
And to accept the enchantments that are required.
Exactly. And the deck planks. This is the details part that I love. The deck planks are woven with true water so that they are fire resistant, because they will be fired upon with fire cannons. And gee, fire burns wood rather easily. So they're enchanted with true water to make them fire resistant. I love this part there. So
not fireproof, but to help them stand up against.
Yeah. The Crystal Raiders ships are primarily powered by oars. A few have sails. The larger ones have sails. They will catch wind, because at those altitudes, the wind is rather powerful. A whole lot more than it is closer to the ground. The motion of the oars combined with the willpower of the rower provides the magic to move the ships. Now, that's basically through most of the ships. The ones in Thera are actually using slaves under the power of spells to generate that willpower to move the ship.
So, yeah, well, there's kind of two things going on here. The Crystal Raider Jakars and a lot of the Barsavian airships, the merchant vessels and so forth, the galleys and galleons that are constructed in Trevar and Jarrus and Thrall and whatnot, all kind of operate on that law of similarity and the elemental magics and whatnot that have developed to allow that to happen. And so they resemble, at least to a certain extent, actual boats and behave mostly the way that boats typically do.
Yeah.
Theron vessels, the stone airships of the Therons, on the other hand, the vedettes are the ones that are sort of most boat-like, but they're still even like that, I think, more like barges than they are keeled sailboats or galleys or anything like that.
Yeah.
But then you get into the Keelas and the behemoths, which...
Bricks.
They are flying castles. They are flying mountains.
Yes.
That is like a demonstration of the Theron magical power. They have the magical might to basically defy the laws of
similarity
physics. I put that in the laws of physics.
Yes.
To put that in scare quotes,
magical physics.
They are powerful enough that they don't need to massage things with the law of similarity in order to get things to fly. They just have enough raw magical power through the result of sacrifice magic.
Yes.
Through the slaves that drive them.
Agreed.
To defy the laws of nature in that regard, which is, of course, high hubris and not at all in any way related to the reasons why Thera might explode down the road when the magic level continues to drop.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's the difference between I have crafted a ship that treats the air as if it's water versus F you, I've got a flying mountain.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. There's two different methodologies there. So the ships are powered by oars. The sails, of course, since we're talking about the details of things that are, of course, imbued with true air, the sails are made from a very strong, heavy, close woven cloth. And you know what that cloth is called? Denim.
Yeah, is it? Okay.
Denim. That's what jeans are made of, people. So that's where jeans came from. Denim.
And actually, bit of trivia is the reason it's called denim is because it was a fabric that's originally developed in France.
Oh.
In a town called Nîmes. Because in French, it's denim, of Nîmes. That's where that came from, is a very sturdy, strong fabric.
Absolutely.
And was used for durable clothing quite a bit before Levi Strauss was able to market it.
Yeah.
Yeah, did his marketing magic, because everything is built on the foundations of previous stuff.
Totally. Totally, totally. So the last little bit about the airship crew, since they all row, and some of them do have sails, there are four positions you can have on a Crystal Raider Drakkar. And I say that because there are other positions to have on other ships in Thera and whatnot. Crystal Raider crews have four positions. Captain, person in charge, the helmsman, the beater, and the crew. Now, elementalists are prized to have on the ship. They would be part of the crew. Beaters just keep the rowing time by banging on that drum. So if you're not the captain who's barking orders, the helmsman, of course, is the navigator slash pilot, and the beaters are the ones keeping rowing time, you know, stroke, 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 things like that. Anybody else on the crew, anybody else on the is part of the crew. And so you're the rowers, you're the riggers, you're the ones doing the lowering and rising of sails and all that fun stuff.
Because of the magic that's involved, there would even be a bit more, I would expect, ritual and ceremony involved in the operation of an airship, because that would help focus the wills, that would focus the people who are operating the ship in order to fuel that magic to go on.
Yeah.
And that's probably the case, not just with the Crystal Raiders, but because of the spirituality and the significance of the Drakkars in Crystal Raider culture, because without the Drakkars, they would not be Crystal Raiders, in a sense.
Yes.
That ceremony and that ritual would be hugely important, just as a cultural aspect, not, you know, not to mention the fact that it is, to a certain extent, probably required in order to have the ship behave the way that you want it to.
Yes.
That the ability of a ship to survive an attack, to get through the challenges and obstacles and stuff that it might face, is as much, if not more, a function of the crew's ability to focus and maintain that magic as it is for the vessel to physically be able to put up with the abuse. I mean, there is a combination of the two that go on there, but whereas with a more traditional sailing vessel, obviously the crew is important, but the physical integrity of the boat is pretty notable. With an airship, a little bit of a hole in the hull, it's not like it's going to be letting water in that's going to like make things heavier and drag you down.
Yeah.
But the ability of the crew to remain focused and to remain focused on their task could allow the vessel to survive or persevere under conditions or circumstances that might, without the magic involved, scuttle a more traditional boat in that regard.
Agreed. So this is the survival guide. This is kind of how to survive if you are encountering any of the Crystal Raider cultures. If you are encountering being raided by them, you can almost identify who is what. And these are the details that I like to include when I'm describing what the airship looks like that's coming at my party. Or if they're attacking my party, I know that the deck planks are woven with true water. I know that the sail has true air in it, and so forth and so on. I just like having all these little details so that I understand the setting better, and I can present that setting to my players and really enrich the game.
Yeah, and help that sense of immersion when you're dealing with games like Earthstone or any kind of game where the setting is a huge part of it and a huge part of the draw, immersing your player characters and really getting them to, I mean, if that's your thing, to really get them to feel like they are in the setting and behave to whatever extent they can as if they are actual people within that setting and how they would react and deal with things like that.
Yeah, that's my goal.
Again, enhancing the realism for whatever definition of that you care to have and the verisimilitude of how things behave and the consequences and underlying motivations and things that kind of fall on from the environment and culture and history of the various peoples involved.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on what we've covered tonight?
I was on the soapbox quite a bit earlier. I don't think I deserve any more thoughts tonight.
Yeah, you do. It's your show.
Our show.
I know.
No. I don't know whether we will have one more episode on the Trolls. I have really enjoyed this series. I have mentioned multiple times how much I've enjoyed going back through this book.
Oh, yeah.
As one of the last books that was published for first edition, this book is in many ways a microcosm, an encapsulation. What the later development of the game grew into and among the best indications of what the game was capable of from a setting development standpoint.
Yeah.
And how it all develops with its own sort of internal logic from the premises of earlier years without necessarily all of that detail having been planned out ahead of time.
Yeah. No, fantastic work all around, top to bottom, core book to the end books. Fantastic work. So folks, if you have any questions for us, please drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com or tell us a story, you know, either way. Doesn't have to necessarily always be questions. So, until next time, go practice your Jar'Arak for your legend.
Good night, everybody.